Welcome, adventurer, to the Level Up Board Game Podcast, a show that uses your experiences and opinions to discuss board games and the gaming community. Join the heroes as they conquer perils such as meeples, cards, and miniatures, all in an effort to level up. You're listening to the Level Up Board Game Podcast.
Hey, adventurers. Today we have a great guest with us, two guests with us, actually. They are the designers of a game that had a successful Kickstarter called Thurgy?
Theogy.
We are going to find out exactly Thiamin. How to say
I think,
this here.
I think it's Thorgy's... a vitamin on the back of a food label.
Yes, how do you say the name of the game correctly?
Yep. So you say the name Theogy.
Theurgy. Like theological, yeah, theologians, theurgy.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. If we could, I'd love to have you guys introduce yourselves.
I'm Ollie. I'm one of the designers of Theurgy, along with Charlotte.
Hello, and I'm Charlotte, one of the designers of Theurgy, along with Ollie.
Well, it's awesome to have you guys with us here today. One of the things we like to ask, what types of games got you into the hobby? What's one of your favorite games that you love to play?
Yeah, Charlotte, do you want to go for that first?
Sure. So I got into board gaming because of Ollie, actually. When we became friends at university, he really threw me in the deep end with Twilight Struggle, Terraforming Mars, before doing any gateway games. But it worked, you know.
Ollie, you're supposed to start with Catan and Carcassonne.
No, Terraforming Mars straight away, I thought, was a sensible introduction to board gaming.
So, I think my current favorite game is probably Robinson Crusoe. We're working our way through the campaign. So, yeah, I think we got further in through it before, but we restarted. So we're on the second scenario again now. We're really enjoying that at the moment.
How many times have you died already?
Quite a few. I think we've won maybe 4 or 5 times out of 30 or something. So not that great. Yeah.
But hey, it says something about the game if you've died that many times and you still keep coming back to it. So that's great.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, we love it, don't we?
Ollie, what are your games?
So I had a slightly different experience to Charlotte. I kind of grew up playing games with my dad and my brother. So our sort of all-time family favourite is actually Agricola. We play a lot of Agricola. But other games that I've really enjoyed are Scythe and Inish and Dominant Species. They were sort of probably my three, including Agricola, maybe 4 favourite games. So we played a lot of those as well.
Great repertoire of games you have there that you choose from. Now then, later on, we are going to be doing our 8-bit breakdown of Theurgy, but we wanted to get an idea what went into it. What's really brought this game to life? What brought you to the idea that made you think, let's make
a game? I can do this.
Theurgy was an idea that I just sort of had in my head and put on paper while I was studying for my postgrad degree at university. And I didn't really think it was going to go anywhere, but when I sort of suggested the idea to Charlotte, she thought it was quite cool. So we ended up actually becoming a thing, which was wonderful. I guess the initial inspiration of the game was actually Pandemic. In Pandemic, you're trying to take cubes off the board. And so my very first initial thought was, I'd like to design a game where actually you're sort of putting cubes on, maybe changing the colours of the cubes. That was the very basic idea that I had at the beginning. As I kind of already mentioned, some of my favourite games to play are area control games like Scythe, Inish, Dominant Species. So I wanted to create a game in that sort of vein, a game with that sort of style. Scythe is definitely one of our favourite games to play, but it's a little bit complicated. It's it's sort of slightly more towards the heavy end. So I wanted something which, in terms of complexity, maybe was about halfway to Scythe. So those were the initial ideas that were sort of going round in the early process. I produced a very kind of rough prototype. I showed it to Charlotte, and then she basically improved it in every way.
Give us some of the story behind that, because we hear that often where, you know, I had an early prototype and then bam, now we have a real thing. And the only transition that anyone gets to hear is, oh, we improved it. I'm picturing lined paper with crude drawings in pen, which makes sense. And then how do you get it from that to the prototype that you guys sent us, that nice thick cardboard with the nice colors, it's vibrant. There's got to be a lot of steps in doing that.
So, like, one of the very first prototypes Ollie showed me was definitely kind of hand-drawn, some hexes that had been cut out. It was called Monsters and Miracles, but it had no monsters or miracles because he wanted the the pilgrimage mechanic to work first and to spread the word. So it was a very different game. Once we started adding in Monsters and Miracles, making all these cards, we went through dozens of packs of blank cards where we printed out images and text and stuck them on multiple times as we were editing them, crossed things out till it got unplayable and our friends were unable to read it. So our poor housemates had to play it a lot. Over time we kind of changed all the effects, changed the mechanics, took it to playtesting groups and got feedback. There used to be like three different ways to spread the word. So when you're placing a faith token onto a hex, and they were like, this is just too complicated. It's a very simple action. It should just be put one down. So we had to work out a way to do that while keeping some of the interesting mechanics, like being able to replace someone's faith token as well as just put one down in an empty space.
I like the idea that you started out with a game called Monsters and Miracles, but there weren't monsters and miracles. It sounds like you started the development of the game very mechanic forward. You wanted to make sure that you had a functioning mechanic, and then you can build the shell around it. The monsters are fantastic. That might be my favorite part of the game, the fact that you place a monster or you get another one down, and suddenly you, every time you select that miracle action, you have multiple monsters. It's like getting bonus actions by having monsters on the board. I really, really like that. But that's not a main mechanic of the game. That's something that you can do. It's sort of secondary to your four main action selections. Oh, and this, that neat thematic element of having a monster, we're going to worry about that later. That's the easy part. It sounds like through playtesting, you were able to really hammer down the main mechanics of the game so that everything functions appropriately. And it sounds like you guys streamlined it too, using the feedback that you got from your playtesters before you got to the fun part. I know if I was developing a game, the first thing I would be doing is making the art for the monsters and putting giant teeth on them.
Yeah.
I would have chutes and ladders with monsters in it.
I was just going to say the monsters were one of the hardest things to get right in the game. They definitely took way longer than the miracles as well.
Is that right?
Because, we had to balance all the effects across the different settlement types, across different like passive, active, roaming, territorial, to make sure there was kind of an even spread, that one territory didn't just have monsters that moved cubes around or removed them, or wounded acolytes. We wanted to make sure that wherever you are on the board, there was kind of a chance of different things happening. So you wouldn't just always want to go to the forest if you liked a certain strategy, for example. And then quite late into development, just before we kind of ordered our first prototype from the game crafter, we went through and changed all the monster names and flavor text and locations to make them more thematic. There was a point where like the elf and the, like, everything was in the fishing village, and I was asking Ollie, why is it in the fishing village? And he's like, I don't know, it got there on a boat.
Elves do that. That makes sense. Thematically, elves, fishing villages, and boats, so I can follow along with that. No, I understand. Yeah,
like, but maybe not, village. Like, dragons and things like that.
Now, what I like to think is that, now, do you still have this? I'd like to think that you have the original hand-drawn stuff in a little envelope in a safe location. Do you still have the original prototype that you drew out and everything?
Oh, do we? I don't remember throwing it away, so hopefully it's somewhere.
You definitely have early prototypes. So the very first one, I remember you had those like little circles with the landscapes. I think what you might have done is stuck more pictures on top of them. So we have them, but it doesn't look quite the same as it was originally, yeah.
I want to ask, for listeners' sake, maybe you guys can give us an idea. Let's suppose I have an idea for a Kickstarter in my head. Now, your Kickstarter is not a card game. This was an ambitious project. You have tiles, you have tokens, cards. meeples, cubes. You've got the action selection pawn, discs. There's a lot of content in this box. So you want to get something from your head, from the loose leaf paper, into a box and actually create it. And you mentioned the Game Crafter, for example. What is the cost of doing something like that?
Right, so it's not a cheap process, that's for sure. This was definitely a very ambitious project, and I don't regret it at all, because obviously it's turned out really well. But in hindsight, if it's going to be your very first game you're producing, it might be more sensible to go for something with fewer components and slightly kind of cheaper upfront costs.
But then again, the first game that she introduced her to was Terraforming Mars. And
right.
You're used to jumping into deep end.
So it definitely is expensive. In terms of kind of the overall process, the first thing you want to do when you're going through that playtesting stage is try to use as many components as you can from other games so that you're not spending lots on meeples and cubes and cards and so on. So that's for kind of the early stage. And obviously making prototypes by hand as well is quite a cost-effective way of doing it. Eventually you get to the stage where you want to start getting some blind playtesters and eventually sending the game off to reviewers. And because the way the game looks really can sort of affect people's enjoyment of the game, how sort of immersive they find the experience, we thought it was worth kind of spending a little bit more. So the Game Crafter isn't especially cheap. It's a while since we had them made, but I think they were about $200 or something.
I think it was half that. Maybe a bit less. We ordered two at the same time.
Yeah, and then a bit less.
Per copy? Per prototype copy?
Yeah, maybe it was closer to $120, and it was because we ordered two.
Yeah, I think it seemed more expensive to us as well, because the Game Crafter is based in the US, and we were ordering it to the UK, and so we had to pay customs. it was a kind of a double blow for us. But yes, if you're making it in the Game Crafter and sending it to US reviewers, it's much cheaper. So.
Well, I regret passing that on to the next reviewer. I should have sold that.
They're expensive things to make, but they're worth it. I mean, we obviously don't have lots of review copies as a result. But it's not something you want to invest in until you've really gone through all the playtesting, really refined the components that you actually need, got the cards pretty much sorted. Before you start spending serious money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess also if you're making a game with less components, we made one with a lot, it would be cheaper as well.
Let's talk a little bit about art. This game has some fantastic art, and I noticed in the Kickstarter, for example, all of the miracles in the prototype copy have the one image, which was fine, but it said, you know, we're going to be able to put different art on each of them. You credit four artists on your on the Board Game Geek page. Are these friends? Did you have to go to a website to track them down? Did you say, hey, we're making a game, and they approached you? Tell us a little bit about how one would go about getting artists to produce art for their game.
So finding artists is actually a really, really fun part of the process. That's sort of the pre-Kickstarter bit that I enjoyed the most. So the way that we found our artists was on BoardGameGeek. So there are forums on BoardGameGeek. There's a forum devoted to board game art. And lots of artists post there when they're looking for work. So what we did was go through this forum, check out these artists' portfolios, found the artists with work that we really like. We like their style. Got in contact with a whole bunch. Some obviously were just very busy. Some were sort of way out of our price range. So it took a little bit of time to find artists that we sort of were happy to work with. But we ended up with a bunch of artists who produced really nice stuff at a price that we could afford. So it was perfect.
For me, I think, oh, okay, I'm just going to go to Kickstarter, say, I want to put out a game. Here we go.
Click that button.
And that's it. I'm sure there's a lot more to it. I mean, you've got to build up the excitement. You've got to build up the froth of people wanting to buy the game and everything. What all goes into the pregame of clicking the button to start the Kickstarter?
So one thing is just making sure the page looks really good so that when people do find the page, they want to back. Ideally, they want to back when they see the page and they're not clicking remind me. They're going, oh man, I want this game now, and backing straight away. So to make the page look good, you obviously need a lot of graphic design, and really you need a professional graphic designer. You're showcasing some of your art, but you're also explaining the game in a kind of clear, accessible way, giving people a sense of the gameplay, and making them excited about the mechanics. A really cool Kickstarter video doesn't hurt either. that's pretty important. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is obviously getting people to actually turn up to the page in the first place to know that you exist. Part of that is sending prototypes to reviewers and getting them to share the game with their followers. We sent it to a whole bunch of reviewers, which was great, and that got us a little bit of a following. We have a website where people were kind of organically coming to our website, and we were directing them to a mailing list and building up a mailing list that way. And then as the kind of the Kickstarter campaign was approaching, we were running lots of Facebook ads as well. The very first time we ran the campaign, so we ended up running the campaign twice. The first time we didn't fund.
I saw this about a year ago. Mm. This was up, and I said that it was canceled. Somebody actually commented on Board Game Geek, I was secretly happy that it was canceled because I'll have money next time they launch and I can back it. I thought, hey, that's...
Yeah, definitely.
So what happened?
So we launched in March 2020, which in hindsight wasn't the best time to launch. We had a bunch of events planned in Glasgow and London. We were meeting up with gaming groups. We went to a convention right at the beginning of March, and then lockdown in the UK.
Yeah, I was going to say, what happened in March of 2020 that possibly have derailed a Kickstarter campaign?
Yeah, it wasn't the only reason, definitely. I think we improved the look of the page a lot. We also spent the last year developing an AI solo mode to kind of appeal to more players, and also just to improve the experience overall. You can add in an AI in a two-player game, for example, so it's like playing a three-player game and so on. And yeah, we commissioned a bit more art this time as well and got some more reviews. But some other fun things that we did to try and build an audience, we made some board game puzzles. So we would set up a game like Carcassonne, or what other ones did we do? Azul?
We did a whole bunch. We did one for Scythe.
Wingspan, I think. Took photos and asked what the most optimal move is, or if people could spot where they should put this particular tile that would be the most efficient or effective in a certain sense. And they were quite popular on Board Game Geek, and I think we got some people signing up for the mailing list through that as well. And it was just fun to do.
Oh, yeah.
I
would be nervous doing something like that, because you'd put together a setup in Azul and you'd have the tiles down, and you'd be like, okay, so if they took the red tile and placed it here, that would score them the most points. I would be the person that would post that, and then other people would be like, no, you idiot, if you put the blue here, and I'd be like, oh, I incorrectly solved my own puzzle.
Sorry, I was going to say, Charlotte made it sound easier than it was. There was quite a lot of time that went into putting together those puzzles to try and make sure that we really had sort of worked out the optimal move. But also, we weren't sort of too worried about it. If someone had a better move, then that was great, and we kind of encouraged them to post it.
At the end of the day, it's all for fun.
Exactly, yeah.
What was it like sitting there seeing a live Kickstarter? What did you go through? What feelings did you go through as you watched the pledges come in and go up?
Yeah, I mean, we are grinning now, but it was an absolutely terrifying experience for sure. It was a real roller coaster. So the first day of our successful campaign went really well. I think officially it was like 62-63% funding on KickTrack. But because of when we started at 3 PM. So I think like over the first actual 24 hours, or by the end of the second day or something, we were at like 75%, something like that. It was looking really good. And then the second day just slowed down dramatically. So we were like, oh, we thought we'd be funded. Yeah, exactly. We were like, oh, we're just about to fund. Oh no, we're stalled. But then it picked up again on like the fourth day or something. So it was a real roller coaster. We kind of knew roughly the way a Kickstarter should go in terms of funding trajectory. Like, we knew that in the last couple of days, in theory, you should raise close to what you raised in the first couple of days. but we didn't really believe it.
You're like, my campaign is going to be the exception. Everybody else gets that last jolt of money but mine, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Lies, all lies.
Exactly. So we were getting to the last couple of days thinking, you know what, this has gone really well and we're happy, but this will probably be it. And then it was really nice to actually see that boost in the last couple of days as well. Mm-hmm. So it was a roller coaster of emotions for sure.
Yeah. It also felt like such a long month. Like, oh like time just felt like it was going so slowly.
I would wear out the refresh button on my computer trying to see that number just go up and up and up. But you know what? You had a successful Kickstarter. In the end, there were 1,016 backers that pledged £53,660, which we're in America. I am assuming that that's $1 billion. I have no idea. But you have enough money. You're in that process now where, Scott, you said you'd be nervous all through the campaign. You know where it would settle with me is, oh, crap. We got to actually make this thing happen. So tell us a little bit there. Kickstarter's over. You got everyone on board. They're amped up. They're excited. Ball's in your court now. You've got to produce.
Yeah. And I mean, that is a whole different kind of nerve. But we had most of the process kind of planned in advance before we launched the Kickstarter. So we sort of know what we need to do. There aren't too many unknowns. One of the really big jobs that needs doing before we can actually start manufacturing is getting all the artwork done. Because we couldn't afford to get it all done pre-campaign, just the sort of a few pieces to showcase. So that's the kind of the big job. There are lots of sort of fiddly jobs, like some sorting out the pledge manager and getting the all the logistics kind of sorted, but we're working with some sort of great partners, so it should be all relatively smooth sailing.
Knock on wood.
Are you opening up anything for late pledges or waiting for retail to come out? If someone missed out on the Kickstarter, what can they do?
Yeah, so we're definitely going to have a late pledge option. It's still in the process of being set up, so. I think the best way to know when it's live is probably either through our mailing list or on our Facebook group, but it should be coming soon. Yeah, in terms of retail, we've had a few kind of small retailers message us who are interested in stocking the game, but it's definitely not going to be kind of widespread circulation at this stage. Maybe in the future if Theurgy's a smash hit, but for now, the best way of getting yourself the game is definitely through a late pledge.
And Charlotte, that late pledge, in order to find out when it comes up, you said you want to get on the mailing list. That's through your website. Can you give everyone that website address?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it's ministryofmeeples.com.
Fantastic. Adventurers, you know where to go to get a hold of Theurgy. We've talked an awful lot about the Kickstarter process. Scott, the Level Up 8-Bit Breakdown?
It sounds like a plan to me.
Holly and Elizabeth are going to be waiting for us, so let's give the quick 8-bit breakdown to Theurgy. Let's give the adventurers a little feel of this game, and let's start with number one, the art and components. Now, let's start right here. In talking with Holly and Elizabeth, they both said they're not miniatures types. Like, I was checking out their Kickstarter campaign, and there were a lot of people saying, oh, it should be more deluxe. And one of their key things that they were stressing was, look, we're not minis, gang, you know, we don't want to get into that realm. They did say they added the deluxified meeples so you can get your monster shaped like the various monsters, but this is not a component forward game. Would you agree?
Yeah, exactly. And anymore, whenever you get any sort of a Kickstarter game or anything like that at all, you're getting box upon box of miniatures and added materials and everything else. It's nice to get something that's just small, compact, easy to deal with. It doesn't give you that stress of, oh God, we got to set this up. This is going to take a half an hour to get everything set up where we need it. You can just set this up quickly, play it, and enjoy it.
You know, adventurers, I'm sure many of you have checked on Board Game Geek to see what people say about a game like Bloodborne or Dark Souls or one of these mega Kickstarters, and a lot of the comments that you see that are negative tend to lean towards, you know, oh, it's a box of toys with just a, you know, a little bit of gameplay pasted on, or the fifth expansion box that was added in the Kickstarter is literally a bunch of plastic and then this off to the side kind of tacked on expansion. It is refreshing that they focused on their gameplay with Theurgy. This is not a what else can we throw into the pot. What we have is good. We're gonna release it as is. I don't want to say that it's minimalistic. I mean, the game has a ton of pieces, and they could have been miniatures. The monsters, every single one of the monsters could be a miniature, and I think there's folks that would gobble it up. But there is something refreshing about the fact that, like, here's a game. This feels like something you would get from Mayday or Days of Wonder.
Yes.
Here's the game. It is a high quality game. You don't need distractions from, you know, look at this mini.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so many times it feels like the miniatures are put there to overshadow a lackluster game or a very basic game. This one here, mm-hmm. there's a lot in it, a lot of meat on the bones for the game, that it doesn't need all that pomp and circumstance to make it that much more attractive.
Let's get right to bit number two, theme and immersion. Now, there are times in games when a mechanic works so well and the action that it carries out on the board is actually immersive. Do you at any point feel like a half-forgotten god battling to bring about the strength of your religion? You might not feel like a half-forgotten god, but I tell you what, you do feel like you're spreading the faith and converting followers.
That is one of my favorite things in this. Whenever you make a miracle happen and you convert the cubes on the board, that is such a fulfilling feeling. You feel happy that you're taking those gray cubes off and putting your color cubes on. In something so simple, they really captured the theme of it.
It's thematically relevant. Here you have all these gray cubes, these non-believers, and there are ways that you can send your one character to go and convert them. You know, they give a speech, they talk up the faith, or you play a miracle card. These people saw a miracle from your god, so now suddenly they're all about your faith. It makes sense. Monsters that roam around the board. If one of your monsters goes onto a tile, it converts a bunch of the cubes that are on the board because, I mean, they saw this creature, this mythical beast. Okay, I'm sold. I believe. The actual mechanisms that are in the game sell the theme. The immersion is a tough one for me because I never feel like a character. You know, it's not a role-playing game. I'm never imagining myself in the boots of a character in a game. But the theme shines through, and you do start to feel like you're a part of it.
I completely agree.
Let's kick up complexity. We're going on to bit number three. What do you think about the complexity of Theurgy?
Complexity... It's kind of a tough thing there because just coming into it quickly, learning it, trying to play it right away and do well, it does feel a bit complex. But whenever you look at the mechanics, it's not that bad. I mean, it's a meaty game, but it's not one that's overwhelming. Yeah, you need a couple of plays under your belt to really feel comfortable and be able to then... Okay, this is what I'm going to do for my strategy. Mm-hmm. This is how I'm going to do things. With the number of monsters, the number of how you can move around the map and
the
make
player
a difference,
powers.
Yeah, you're really never going to play the same game twice. It's not like, well, I need to do this first, this first, this first. You may do that, but you're going to use different powers, different players, different cards, different monsters. There's all sorts of X factors in this that make it a great game for continued play.
I thought Theurgy was just over like what you might think the median, the halfway of complete, like a 2.5 on BGG. I think it's just over that. Like it's not easy, but it's not overly difficult. There's a lot of things to grasp at the beginning. You have your god with its own player power, and then you have the four primary actions that you select from. It borrows that scythe mechanic where whatever you picked on this turn you cannot pick next turn. It doesn't have the top action bottom action like scythe does, but it did borrow that action selection pawn. Once you learn those four actions, then you've got to understand how to best utilize them. And that's where the complexity comes in. One of the actions is test the faith. Now, this is an area control game. You want to have your cubes, you want to have your believers on the board, but having more in an area than someone else only does you so good. You still have to test the faith. You still have to outnumber them and have those faith tokens surrounding the hex on the vertices of the hexes. Then test the faith, then get your temple built. That's the goal of the game. Trying to figure out how to get from point A all the way to, you know, point R. There's a lot of little steps in it. You've got to sort of do it once to understand. But overall, I didn't think that this was overly complex. I thought that the game was pretty easy to grasp. One play in, by the time we hit our second or third play, it's easy.
Yes.
So let's talk about the rule book. We have the prototype copy. This just funded on Kickstarter. So our rule book was a prototype copy. It was designed so that reviewers could quickly understand the game. And it was kind of conversational. Like, you could tell that this was, you know, they knew that it was one person speaking to another. I imagine that their final rule book will probably be a little bit small. Like, it said things that, like, we have found that test the faith is the most difficult action to understand. That's probably not going to be in the final rule book. I don't know. Maybe all I can clarify. But it was thorough. It took me one quick read through. I set the game up, moved some pieces around by myself, and I was like, oh, God, I can teach this. No problem. How'd you feel learning it? Bit number five, the learning curve.
You're a little unsure. Everything's there put out for you. It's very simple to see. You do this, you do this, you do this. But I think that the learning curve, once again, it comes into the order of how you want to do it. You're going to make mistakes your first playthrough. You aren't going to play as optimally as you want to play. But that's, I think, is a good sign of a good game. Because if you go into it and you just wipe it up and wipe everyone out, you have all the rules figured out, how much replayability is there after that? You don't have any of that mystery that you want to try and go into and figure, well, what if I try this next time? What if I try this next time? The learning curve is there, but it still leaves openness for you to go in and explore and really
there's more to discover.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Would you say that this is something that you could introduce to your in-laws? Now, I know that, let me rephrase that. I know this isn't an in-law approved game. You're not going to sit down and be able to show them this. Mm-hmm. So maybe to give the listener an idea of what I'm trying to ask is, could you sit down with people that aren't normally gamers? Would this be one that you would introduce them to? Or is this something that you're reserving for the game group?
With the game group, definitely, this would be coming out. There's no question about that at all. But as far as introducing people to this game that aren't really gamers or anything, I think it's one of those ones where you want to play a couple other board games beforehand, then say, hey, you remember how we did this in this game and this in this game? We're going to put those together and give it a try in this game now.
Bit number six, we talk about replayability and variability. We already brushed on it a bit. This game gives you different monsters to choose from. You start the game with a different god to choose from. Ultimately, you're going to be playing the same game. I like to always say, you know, you're in the same sandbox, just with different toys, right? But make no mistake, having a ton of variables with a setup doesn't make this game more or less replayable. It just makes it variable. I find it very replayable, as there's a great bit to explore with the monsters, combining them, the various gods. I want to see what miracles I can combine with what monsters have the most profound effect. I thought the variability in the game is fantastic. You said it earlier. You're never going to play the same game twice. I think the replayability, I think oftentimes we confuse replayability with how many variables are there? How many times is it going to be different when I play? Sometimes games don't need to be different every time to be replayable. A game like chess. There are people that have played their 10,000th game of chess. It's never different. The pawn always moves the same way. The knight always moves the same way. I think Thaergy kind of fits that bill in that you're doing the same thing, but it's so engaging. It's so fun. There's a bit of take that. Oh, I got this monster this time. I thought just infinitely replayable. It's one that's going to be a staple on the shelf for me.
It's definitely one that I'm going to jump on the late pledge bandwagon with this one, no doubt. The modular game board, being able to change that around with just having the main city in the middle, that's your only constant. Everything else moves around every game. So it goes to bit number 7, our plays and strategy. I enjoyed it. It really made me think of what I want to do the next time I play it. That's a sign of a great game. Whenever you finish playing it and you're like, I want to play this again right now.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
What were your thoughts?
Well, the game definitely wants you to get your temples down. That's the way that you win. And in order to succeed at that, you have to spread the faith. In order to spread the faith, you've got to get your cubes on the board. That's just the basic strategy to play the game. It's like saying in Catan, you need your numbers rolled and you need to build cities and towns. No kidding. But the stuff surrounding it is what starts to make it interesting, how you might have a slightly different way of doing it. I thought that there was a lot of strategy in grabbing a monster or two or three, because then every time you take that miracle's action, the miracle slash monster's action, you get to either perform a miracle or get a monster on the board. You get to activate every monster that's down. They convert cubes. So you have the option of doing that cube conversion action selection where you can take some of the non-believers, turn them into your followers, and you'll get like two. Or you can take the miracles action. Move your monster here, convert. Move your other monster there, convert. Place your new monster here, convert. And it's like, whoa, suddenly you get this engine going. You're like, okay, now I'm rocking. I got these monsters on the board. Also, it's important to keep, I want to call him the acolyte. Keep your meeple that goes around and preaches for you and spreads word of your god. I think it is very important to get him fighting other monsters. We didn't have a lot of that in our game I got to play with you.
Yeah, that was something that was funny. I look at it that no one got monsters to begin with. It was like, who's going to take the first monster? And then once someone got one, put it out, and then it was like, oh, whoa, this is the way to go.
This
is profound. Then all the monsters started going crazy with the monsters then.
They originally titled the game Monsters and Miracles, and you can see why. You know, there's a well-fleshed-out quality game without any of that. And then you mix it in, it's like, whoa, this is the X factor here.
Yeah, it definitely did there. And I don't have it in front of me, but I want to say it looked like there were probably around 20 different monsters, I think.
Maybe even more.
Yeah.
Maybe even more. That's a deck.
Yeah, so you look at that, you're going to be playing that over and over and playing it with different monsters. So you may have missed out on the Harpies this time, and next game, there's the Harpies. I'm going to grab them right now. I saw what they did to me last game. Let's get those out.
Was Theurgy fun, and who's it for? Let's wrap it up. We got Ollie and Elizabeth waiting in the other room.
Yeah.
They don't know what we're doing in here.
Yeah, just a second, guys. Yeah. No, it's fine. Yeah, I had a good time. I was a little hesitant whenever you got out and started talking about it. But as the game progressed, I got more and more into it. And as you said, whenever you're switching out the followers and you're getting followers, there's something that feels so good about that. And I really got lost in the game. I really enjoyed it. Who's it for? It's definitely for your game group. There's no question. I think anybody that plays games normally, they will enjoy this game.
I enjoyed our plays. I would play it again, and I would suggest it again. So when I was thinking about, okay, who's this for? Let's get one thing out of the way. This game is confrontational. You're going to be fighting with each other. Your goal is to get their followers off the board and get yours on the board. So you're not rolling dice and having a war, but it's kind of the same mechanic. You're removing their pieces and adding more of yours. So your group has to be okay with that. I do see people replying to things on Facebook saying, oh, you know, I don't like take that games. I don't like games with conflict. If you're one of those people, you probably won't like the conflict in this game. Somebody's going to move their monster into your territory and it's going to convert some of your cubes. Somebody's going to test the faith and they're going to crumble your temple. And you're like, oh, you know, I mean, if you get bad feelings from that, I mean, we all do. But if that ruins your game day, you know, you can't look at that and go, oh, okay, yeah, the good play. Then you're not gonna love that part. Maybe the best way that I can explain who it's for is this is an area control action selection game with conflict. That's pretty straightforward. I would say the difference between Theurgy and other area control games is that player strategies are gonna branch off real quick. Everyone still has the same ultimate goal, but typically everyone's gonna have a different optimal way to go about achieving that goal with all the variables that the game introduces.
I agree completely.
Well, we're back with Ollie and Charlotte. the creators of the game that we just gave the 8-bit breakdown to, Thurgy. As you can tell, we like this game. I unfortunately shipped out my copy to the next reviewer, and I'm going to be keeping my eyes open for the late pledge. In the meanwhile, guys, I told you there'd be nothing unexpected in our little talk today, but I lied. We are the Level Up Board Game Podcast, and moving forward, whenever we have designers on, we want to give them the opportunity to level up. Now, I would say there are no right or wrong answers, but believe me, there are wrong answers. Scott, start the timer.
And go.
What color do you play as?
Red.
If you got in a fight with Jamie Stegmaier, who would win?
Jamie Stegmaier.
Can you ride a bike without holding on to the handlebars?
No.
Coffee or tea?
Tea.
What is the best movie ever made?
About Time.
Beer or whiskey?
Whiskey.
Who would win in a level up host fight between Scott and Patrick?
Scott.
Famed designer of Wingspan, Elizabeth Hargrave, challenges you to a dance-off. Who would win?
Elizabeth.
Can we agree that French fries are not called chips?
No.
How many resource cubes can you stack without them toppling over?
Four.
Time. All right. Thank you, Ollie. All right. You know what that means. Charlotte, you're on the clock. Are you ready to try and level up?
Probably not. That's fine.
Scott, get the timer ready.
All right. And go.
What is cooler, a Velociraptor or an Autobot?
A Velociraptor.
You're offered $10,000 or pounds to get the Monopoly Man tattooed on your forearm. Do you do it?
No.
Which Thaergy monster is your favorite?
With a warlock.
Why do you call the bathroom the loo?
Because I'm a bit too British.
Winston Churchill and John Wayne arm wrestle. Who wins?
John Wayne.
The Major League Baseball team Pirates play for which city?
No idea.
What's the best dessert on the planet?
Chocolate cake.
You can have access to every game and people to play with at all times, but you will lose every time. Do you take that deal?
Sounds normal.
With a running start, could you jump over a shopping cart?
No.
Name a common topping that people put on a pizza that you think is awful.
Pineapple.
Renowned reviewer Tom Vassell walks up to your table in a restaurant, grabs your drink, and finishes it, setting it back on the table, and he asks, what are you going to do about it? Well, what are you going to do about it?
throw a bunch of dice at him? I don't know.
Time.
Well done, Charlotte. Charlotte and Ollie. Well done.
We really do appreciate the time you spent with us. We've had a lot of fun. We've gotten a lot of look behind the scenes as to what goes on with someone who comes up with the idea for a game and wants to do a Kickstarter. Now, for the listeners, website, social media, where they can find information on the game and things that are coming up for you. Floor is yours, guys.
Oh, cheers. So, yeah, please do check out our website, ministryofmeeples.com. You can find more information about the game there. There are links from the website to our Facebook group for the game. We're fairly active in the Facebook group. If you want the kind of the latest updates on the artwork that's being commissioned, that's a really good place to look, for example. If you want to know more about the sort of the AI mode, the solo mode, the Facebook group is a good place to be. There is a prototype version of Thaergy on Tabletopia that works pretty well. So we actually spend quite a lot of time playing with people on Tabletopia, showing them the game that way. So if you're really keen for a game as well, you can always get in contact with us through the website. And we love playing the game with people.
Adventurers, that is a level up first. That's your opportunity, your invitation to learn Thaergy and play it with the designers. Guys, you're about to get your inboxes flooded. I want to thank you so much. I want to thank you so much for your time today, for scheduling, for producing such a fantastic game. Like I said, I'm going to be keeping my eyes open for the late pledge since I had to ship on the prototype copy that I had. Thank you. Thank you so much, both of you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us on the podcast. It's been really good fun. Yeah, thank you as well.
Yeah, thanks. It's been great.
We want an early invite on the next game, though. So we want to be on the beginning side of it. So keep us in mind, too.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining this adventure of the Level Up Board Game Podcast. We encourage all adventurers to check out our website at levelupgamepodcast.com.
There you can submit your thoughts and audio to be used in a future episode. Please consider rating us on iTunes. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and join the Board Game Geek Guild, Guild 3722. Music for the podcast provided by Adam Haynes. Learn more at adamhaynesmusic.com. And remember, you can spend another night on the sofa, or you can get some friends together, get some adventures on the table, and level up.